Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, watch out for crashes on the 101 westbound at Tatum. That blocks the HOV lane. On I-17 northbound, a crash at Grand Avenue has the HOV lane blocked. Also on the 17 northbound, a crash blocks the shoulder at Camelback. We're looking for a high temperature today of 112 in the valley. Right now, under sunny skies, it's 108 degrees.
A Democratic lawmaker championing a petition drive asking voters to repeal a recent Arizona campaign finance law is pulling the plug on the effort. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, a measure aimed at combating so-called dark money is now dead.
State Representative Ken Clark says he is unable to secure the financial backing to hire paid petition circulators and collect the needed 75,000 signatures before the ballot deadline early next month. The Phoenix Democrat was sponsoring the initiative to let the public decide on legislation he contends limits disclosure and increases spending by anonymous political donors.
The general public understands that dark money is bad. The polls indicate that. But, you know, we were not able to convince the larger money donors to come in and help us.
Supporters of the new law signed by Governor Doug Ducey earlier this year say it's designed to simplify the state's campaign finance code and promote free speech. Clark has dubbed it, though, the, quote, Dark Money Act, and believes it's a veiled attempt to allow big money interests to anonymously intimidate elected officials. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
For the past several weeks, nearly two dozen cases of measles have been identified. As KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, the cases stem from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement employees who refuse to be vaccinated or show proof of vaccination.
As we first reported earlier this month, health officials believed an 8-month-old child was exposed to the virus, but the family refused testing. So what happens when a person doesn't want to be tested for a contagious and potentially deadly disease? It depends.
So there's certain diseases like smallpox where we can actually require vaccination because it could be so contagious and so lethal. A lot of the authorities that we have, though, allow public health to exclude people, isolate them, or quarantine them.
That's Jessica Rigler with the Arizona Department of Health. She says measles is one disease where DHS is limited in its authority. While it can quarantine a person, it can't make them get tested or vaccinated. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Abortion providers have filed a federal lawsuit seeking to block a new state law aimed at preventing them from getting public money. The law allows the director of Arizona's Medicaid program to disqualify any provider that does not fully separate tax dollars it gets from money it uses to provide abortions. Elizabeth Nash tracks abortion laws at the state level. She's the senior state issues advocate at the Guttmacher Institute, which favors reproductive rights.
What we saw this year was that Arizona had been unsuccessful in kicking Planned Parenthood out of Medicaid back in 2012. So this is basically the next bite at the apple, which is that the legislature adopted this bill that said that the state could essentially kick out of Medicaid, so these organizations could no longer be Medicaid providers if they did any one of a number of things that the legislature said were impermissible. And one of them was this segregation of funds around abortion. And the piece that might be helpful to listeners here is that the federal government really hasn't provided any kind of guidelines around what kind of segregation is appropriate for any service.
Are there other states that have tried to take this approach or actually taken this approach?
No. Arizona is the first. And, you know, what we've seen over the past year or so is really about half the states have tried to kick Planned Parenthood out of various funding streams, be it Medicaid or other dollars related to family planning services. But this is the first state where we've seen a bill to redefine how to exclude a provider from Medicaid. It appears that it's coming from the same place, that there are legislators who want to exclude Planned Parenthood from Medicaid, and because they were unsuccessful in 2012 with essentially
a straight out, let's kick Planned Parenthood out of Medicaid bill. This is another approach to try to do that in a different way.
Do you think that means that other states will be watching what happens with this lawsuit to see if they might want to introduce something similar down the road?
Absolutely. You know, what we've seen around the issue of Medicaid and Planned Parenthood is that governors who have tried to kick Planned Parenthood out of Medicaid have generally failed. There have been a number of court cases, and those efforts have been stopped. But then we started to see some states try to exclude Planned Parenthood for what is called for cause, which is that there are reasons that Planned Parenthood is a bad Medicaid provider. And those efforts have fallen flat as well. And so this is a new approach that those who oppose reproductive health, who oppose access to family planning services, will be watching, because if it's successful, we will see it in other states.
Elizabeth Nash is Senior State Issues Advocate for the Guttmacher Institute.
Two protests will be taking place tonight around the Valley related to how police treat communities of color. Last Friday night in downtown Phoenix, a group led by Jarrett Maupin walked through the streets peacefully. That changed a bit near the end of the event when officers used pepper spray to disperse some of the protesters. The rally's change of tone was reflected in Arizona Republic headlines on Saturday morning. But there's been concern expressed on social media that those modified headlines were the result of different editions being sent to different parts of the Valley, rather than the result of rapidly changing news. John Deanna is the Republic's A1 editor, and he joins me. John, what's the process when you're putting an edition to bed? How much does the deadline play a role in making decisions?
I think you hit the right term, which is deadline, and this is purely a deadline situation. We have a group of editors who work in the newsroom at night, and we're all pushing toward that first edition deadline to get the paper on the press, get it out to the delivery trucks, and get it out to your homes. Most of our readers have made real clear that they want their paper early in the morning. So, you know, the deadlines are critical, and we have to hit them at every step along the way. That said, when news happens after deadline, we can do what's called a chase. And the chase essentially allows us to update the story, and they put the new version on the presses pretty much while the presses are still running. I mean, they have to slow down briefly to get the new plates on. But the chaser allows us to get breaking news, later breaking news, into the paper. The downside is it doesn't make every edition. The editions that have already been printed still go to wherever they're destined for.
It appeared that different editions went to different parts of the Valley, which gives people some concern based on, does the headline look different? Does a subheading look different? Would different parts of the city get an edition at different times?
That's exactly what happened. You know, as we covered the event early in the evening, it was more subdued and there weren't any real major issues. So the story reflected that, and the headline about having their voices heard, that reflected that story at that time. As the night went on, tensions escalated, and indeed with pepper spray being sprayed, the situation over the at the Interstate 10 developed. We updated the story, but the early first edition had already gone to press. So as the story updated, it reflected the increasing tensions, and so then the headline was changed to reflect those increasing tensions. And that's really all there was to it. As far as different editions going to different parts of the paper, you know, this has happened on the front page before. One really notable example was when the Tempe Town Lake Dam burst. It happened at night just as our first edition was going to print, and so we chased it. We scrambled to get a new story and totally remade the front page, not just the headlines, but, you know, about everything. Unfortunately, because of the timing, none of those editions, none of the people in Tempe got those new editions. Trucks that were headed to Tempe had already picked up their papers from the printing plant and were headed to the doorsteps in Tempe.
John, how do you feel about the reaction the changing headlines generated on social media? Some people were really upset.
What would like to do is make our process as transparent as possible. And again, so that, you know, that's why I'm talking with you, and I'm happy to do it. You know, there is no real great mystery to how the paper comes together. But there are a lot of steps that are involved, and some of them get a little complex and some of them get a little crazy around deadline. But, you know, to think that we deliberately changed a headline to target, a different area of the community, to me that just shows that somebody doesn't know how the newspaper process works. And I've actually reached out to the individual who posted the thing on Facebook and offered to invite him down to the paper, but I haven't heard any response to that.
John Deanna is the A1 editor for the Arizona Republic. John, thanks for the time.
Glad to do it, Steve.
There's a brewing battle in Arizona over the future of effluent. That's the treated water produced by sewage plants. Central Arizona has been a leader in reusing its wastewater. More than 80% is recycled, from irrigating golf courses to replenishing the water table. But some of that water also serves another purpose. It's sustaining many of the state's struggling rivers, as KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
0.2.
Flows about 0.04.
When a sewage plant in Nogales, Arizona made some upgrades back in 2009, the ripple effects were enormous for this once algae-coated river.
Overnight, immediately, fish were suddenly in the water.
The level of nitrogen had been too high till then, says Bertie Stable, as she wades through this knee-deep stretch of the upper Santa Cruz. For two decades, she's not only watched this river come back to life, she's measured it.
For a variety of things like chlorine, dissolved oxygen, electroconductivity.
It's a monthly ritual that a handful of volunteers called Friends of the Santa Cruz River are carrying out on this gray morning. Years ago, Stable says they didn't know this information would be of any use.
When it came time to get the funding for the sewage treatment plant to be expanded, our data was very important.
The plant treats millions of gallons of wastewater from Mexico and southern Arizona each day, and then empties it into the river. Now that's allowed native plants and wildlife to reemerge.
It's full of trees, it's just gorgeous. You hear gray hawks calling. Did you hear that? That's a red tail.
In fact, last year marked the first time in a decade the endangered Gila top minnow repopulated these waters, a testament to how this habitat has rebounded thanks to the discharge of treated water into what would otherwise be a dry river. It's a precious resource that Stable says can't be taken for granted.
Everybody's concerned about that, about losing the effluent. We've been so fortunate to have it these years.
That's not an issue here yet, but travel north to the lower Santa Cruz, and some of that water could be in jeopardy. Two treatment plants run by the city of Tucson sustain habitat and wildlife in that stretch of the river as well.
What we've been trying to do is maximize the value of the effluent.
Lawrence Marquez is with the Bureau of Reclamation, which has proposed diverting about 7,000 acre-feet of that treated water to a nearby irrigation district.
If state law allowed you to get the same value for the effluent, we would certainly consider leaving it in the river. There would be no reason to take it out.
In much of central and southern Arizona, the state gives credits when effluent is put into the ground. Think of it like a bank account. But if the effluent goes into a river instead, the state only gives half a credit. This pilot project will give the Bureau more revenue by selling those credits and will allow it to meet its obligations under a decades-old Indian water rights settlement, says Marquez. He says an environmental analysis shows the diversion won't have major impacts, but conservationists like Ian Dowdy with the Sonoran Institute disagree. He says it will hurt an already water-stretched river.
We need to find a mechanism where water that's being applied to the environment that is making its way into our aquifers can receive a fair amount of credit.
The state doesn't track all the rivers and streams that depend on effluent, but the University of Arizona several years ago identified at least 9 different waterways. Dave White of Arizona State University says one thing is for sure.
We anticipate that there will be increasing conflict over the use of this particular resource in the future.
Especially as Arizona tries to meet a projected supply gap of 1 to 3 million acre-feet of water in the coming decades. While effluent is only a small fraction of the state's overall water budget, he says it's a critical and affordable source.
Arizona does not currently have an adequate policy framework for both encouraging and for managing the environmental uses of wastewater.
Right now, he says, in some cases, effluent makes it into a river incidentally, not as part of a broader state plan. Back on the Santa Cruz, Bertie Stable acknowledges the river isn't constant. It's always been subject to the human and environmental pressures of the Southwest.
I'm a little hopeful that if we are proactive, something can be done to keep enough water in the river.
After all, she says, it's not going to survive by default. Will Stone, KJZZ News, reporting from Tubac.
The official start of the Summer Olympics in Rio is August 5th, and anticipation is building. As part of that, the Arizona Republic is holding a storytellers event next Tuesday at Mesa Arts Center. It'll feature memories from journalists and former Olympians from Arizona. One of those former Olympians is archer Judy Adams. She made the 1980 team, but the U.S. boycott of the Moscow Games put her dreams on hold. She was persistent, but failed in her 1984, 88, and 92 efforts. As a 36-year-old, though, in 1996, she succeeded. Judy, when you were trying to become an Olympian in 1980, were you even thinking about the greater political picture in the world?
Well, I guess I'd have to tell you I was pretty young. And so when there was first mention of a potential boycott, you know, you start the process of grief. I was basically in denial. There's shock and denial. And then I just thought, no, it's not going to happen. There's no way that we won't go. I'd been training for it and was a favorite. So in those days, that was kind of hard to think about. And I just kept training. And literally, they made the decision to officially boycott 4 days after I made the Olympic team. My coach was trying to have me keep it together, you know, and be kind of calm about it. But I was 20. I think I did a good job, you know, of sort of swallowing it all and moving on. But as you get older, what's really interesting is that you have a different perspective on things. And I think the thing I'd say I learned the most with the boycott and then not making the team for 16 years, you think you're young and, oh, that's no problem. I can do it again in the next 4 years. And it doesn't work out. It doesn't work out. It doesn't work out. And then it finally does. I think the biggest thing that I probably learned is that you can't be much of an archer unless you can learn to let go.
Why did it take 16 years? Was it bad luck? Was it better competition? What happened?
If I were to say what it was, when we first boycotted, I thought, wow, I'm really young. I'm 20 years old. I got my whole life ahead of me. Archers, you know, you could have a lot of longevity. But the reality is you're never living at home again. You're never not worried about how you're going to make money. And archers, there aren't professional archers. You're not making a lot of money doing it. And so the reality starts to click in. You go away to college. You learn new things. You get involved in other stuff. And I choked once. Another year, it just wasn't my year. The next time I was the alternate, which that's like the worst. And then I retired.
Were you basically thinking, I'm going to keep trying this until I either finally make this team the way I want to, or it's just a miserable failure, and then I'll decide that's it?
I did actually retire after 92, and my sports psychologist actually is the one that came to me and said, I think you should get back in it. And I told her, I said, well, I just had a baby. I don't think, I want to spend time with him. And she said, you need to do it for him, because otherwise you're going to be sitting there wondering what could have been. She said, you have gone after this for so long. And she was right. Mm-hmm. I made that team.
What about the experience, though, of 96? Do you remember that? Do you remember thinking this was this great festival at that time?
Yeah, I went to 96. I really wanted to experience everything that I hadn't experienced. And I went to 96 clearly wanting to be a part of it, to maybe relax some of that intensity and enjoy what was going around and to see it from other athletes' eyes even and from other perspectives.
Are there any stories other than about 1980 that to you epitomize the Olympic experience you had?
I was the athlete whose mother died while she was at the Games. And I literally had to leave the Games and come home. Mm-hmm. And then go back. And luckily, I was there for long enough that I could leave and come back. But within that, there is an amazing story about my family and that whole 16-year thing coming together.
Arizonan and former Olympics archer Judy Adams. Jeff Metcalf of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central has covered 12 Olympic Games so far. His 13th will be next month in Rio. Jeff, you focus primarily on Arizona athletes over the years. Who is the most memorable?
I already knew Carrie Strug fairly extensively because of her Arizona history, and she had actually gone to the Barcelona Olympics in 92 when she was 14. She was the youngest American athlete in any sport at Barcelona. Now you have to be 16 in the Olympic year, but she was actually able to go at 14 in 92. So I knew her, and I knew her family and the backstory, and just had a, a, a familiarity there that really, when she did that vault in 96 that basically clinched the gold medal for the U.S., you know you're watching a moment that's going to change somebody's life, that's going to be remembered forever. I remember her saying, her and her family kind of being upset because she had to go to the hospital or to the doctor, whatever it was, because of her injury after that vault. And she didn't get to go to the Hard Rock Cafe for an event that was immediately after that competition. I remember thinking, she's going to have so many opportunities in the future that missing the Hard Rock Cafe at that very moment is the least of her least of her worries.
How do you find balancing the results with talking to people who are have really done something interesting, even if they don't win the gold or even the silver?
Yeah. I think you can't go too deep into the X's and O's, if you want to put it that way. I mean, if I tried to do that, in a lot of these sports, like, I'd be over my head in doing X's and O's about synchronized swimming or rhythmic gymnastics or, you know, some of these other sports that Americans just aren't that familiar with. So I think you've got to lean on the storytelling part of it and then put just enough of the specifics in there to satisfy the people that might want some of that.
I don't put this in the category of, are you a dog or cat person, or do you want paper or plastic, but are you a winter or summer Olympic guy more?
For sure summer, because I always want to go and be able to tell the stories of people that I already know. And there just aren't that many winter Olympic connections from Arizona. I went to Russia, and I was working largely for USA Today and Gannett, more so than for the Republic. And I was writing stories for different Gannett publications and websites and various things about athletes that I really wasn't that familiar with. And it was fine. I enjoyed it. I actually enjoyed Russia a lot more than I thought I would. But it's just not the same as, like I mentioned about that Carrie Strug story, where you may know someone from when they're very young and now they're having some incredible Olympic moment and you can relate to it much more so, and you feel much more competent telling that story than you are just someone where you just kind of jump in on it.
Jeff Metcalf of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. He'll be covering the Olympics in Rio, his 13th. Jeff, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And with Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway, I'm Mark Brody. We've been reading a lot about the Rio Olympics coming up in Brazil, and have you noticed there has barely been a single good news story out of Brazil before the Games?
For example, the French president said yesterday that they thwarted a terrorist attack by a Brazilian Islamist militant against the French delegation in Rio.
The police force there has been on strike. There are cost overruns, infrastructure disasters, political confrontations, the ouster of the president, bodies washing up on the beach at the volleyball venue, of course, the Zika virus. Sure, there have been one or two nice breakthrough stories. Michael Phelps is returning for the U.S. team, and the mayor of Rio is really excited for Pokemon Go to get there in time for the games. But bashing the host country is actually nothing new. Think about Athens or Beijing, even the United States, on the receiving end of tons of criticism before hosting the World Cup in 1994. Andre Markovitz is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's authored numerous books and studied comparative sports culture in Europe and North America. And he's here to deconstruct the awful news coming out of Brazil in the run-up to the games. Andre Markovitz, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Is the terrible news coming out of Brazil as remarkable to you as it has been to me? Every story, story after story after story, nothing good coming out of Brazil in the run-up to the games. Is this just what we do?
Well, there is a bit of a difference with Brazil, which is, of course, the Zika virus. That is unique. You mentioned all these other negative things that always accompany mega events for lots of reasons, sometimes quite different. The United States and the World Cup were vilified because, of course, it was the United States at the time, and maybe even still, was not a soccer country. So it was seen as if the Winter Olympics would be held in Senegal. I mean, it was something totally inappropriate. But that's a very different reason than the negative things that were mentioned about Athens, Sochi, London. Those were almost always about the failure of the organization, building not being complete, people not ready, of course, hotel prices jacked up, all kinds of things like that. But it rarely, or in fact, I don't recall ever there being this issue of health. And that, of course, is quite unique. Now, about the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, the president, that is just sort of part of the package. of always having a critical assessment of these Olympics. And I would actually argue that the mega events held in developing countries, such as, for example, South Africa, even, of course, China, and now with Brazil, the negative is even higher. In South Africa, if you call the World Cup 2010, again, issues of safety, things that did not come up with London and the others held in the first world.
So part of this aspect of the media culture we've seen before, sort of a lot of naysaying and foreboding coverage before the big event. Zika might be different because it's a real health issue. And then what happens in the history of sporting mega events? Do the flame gets lit, the events start, and everybody forgets about the bad
exactly.
stuff and just focuses?
Exactly, exactly. The flame gets lit. There's the brilliant opening ceremony, which is, interestingly, with the closing ceremony, the most watched of all the events, showing you that it's sort of a sports is almost incidental. But, of course, there comes the feel-good event for the nation that hosts it, hosts disproportionately and, in fact, by vast amounts, gain in terms of medals. There's the home field advantage is huge. It's a feel-good story for the host nation. I mean, everybody, basically nationalism kicks in, which is the most powerful unifying force in the 20th century or probably even before. Just remember how the Brits went totally gaga over the Olympics in London, delighting about beating the Germans and the Australians in their medal hall. This was a huge issue, almost rivaling the United States.
Right. So Andrei Markovits, let me ask you the key question here, though. What does it say about us that we do this over and over, that we're always so negative and nasty going into the big event, and then it's all washed away, and we're so wonderful once it starts and once it's over?
No. It's only washed away during. And then, of course, the postmortems develop. Which, in fact, are also often negative, and in fact, scathingly so. I mean, the Montreal Olympics was held in 1976. The post-mortem negativity, I think, lasted until a couple of years ago. Basically, the huge the cost overruns, the unnecessary buildings. A very distinguished colleague of mine here at the University of Michigan, Stefan Szymanski, just did a study of the London Olympics, which he shows that the buildings were, I mean, the whole construction, all that was really fraught with difficulty, and the development of London could have been very different. So the post-mortem is not always positive. Basically, the press the media have a role of, you know this better than I do, negativity sells much better. And, you know, journalists like to kvetch, and people worry about these mega events. And let us not forget that at least in the developed world, what has also happened is a fatigue over these mega events. Increasingly, people in Europe and North America are very wary of having them. So typically, the next Winter Olympics were only contested by Kazakhstan and South Korea. The Austrians declined, so this declined, that declined. So in fact, there's a much more critical assessment on the part of the public what the benefit of these mega events is, and maybe just this phenomenal high of the 2 weeks of the duration may not in fact suffice. So I don't think that it's only the lead up that makes us sort of being nasty and kvetchy and crabby that leads to this assessment that you're now seeing with Brazil.
Nasty, kvetchy, crabby, leading up to the big games. We've seen this before. Andrei Markovits has seen it before. He studies comparative sports culture in Europe and North America, professor of political science at the University of Michigan. Professor Markovits, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's the Takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Ashley Ostransky, and I am painting pottery right now.
There's a lot of blue on my tile.
My name is Sophia. You can just basically do whatever you want, and you can express who you are by, like, colors or words.
I kind of like that part because you could do whatever you would want to with it, and you can just make it your own.
Make sure your writing is right side up.
you have to get like the air bubbles out of it by like kneading it almost like dough.
I put enjoy little things because like a lot of little things in life are important.
That's Ashley Ostransky and Sophia DeRose molding clay and painting pottery at Burst of Butterfly Studio in Chandler. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to watch the film Ghost with us, send us a note, the show, at kjzz.org.
In KJZZ News at 2:39, the Fuller Fire burning on the north rim of the Grand Canyon has burned about 3,000 acres. 500 fire personnel are managing the lightning-caused fire that sparked late last month. Fire spokeswoman Michelle Fiddler says crews are focusing on keeping the fire from spreading further into the Kaibab National Forest. She says they're working to protect multiple ecosystems that have not had any previous wildfire burnouts in recent history.
We have opportunities to protect those values at risk. That's where we're focusing our resources. So we have a full range of actions available to us to help suppress portions of the fire as needed or to help direct or confine the fire spread in certain areas.
State Highway 67 and the North Rim developed area remain open, but the fire has resulted in closures of Grand Canyon National Park access roads to the Point Imperial and Cape Royal viewpoints along the North Rim. The Havasupai tribe in northern Arizona this week stopped third-party guide services to Havasupai Falls. The tribe says it's a temporary measure while it works on the licensing process. Social media over the past few months has included photos of and commentary on the poor condition of some horses used on the trails. In an interview late last month, Don Watamogi, chairman of the Havasupai tribe, said the issue had been overblown.
Well, just like any place else, people will see something out of the ordinary. And most of the pack animals are probably not worth taking pictures because they're healthy. But the ones that aren't are noticed.
Watahomiji says tourism is critical to the tribe's economy and that the vast majority of the packers are tribal members, including those who are using horses unfit to be on the trails.
Well, they probably are, but they're probably like some people anywhere else that it's hard to make ends meet, so they're trying to do best they can with what they have.
In a statement, the tribe says the new regulations will address issues including permit fees and private pack animal reservations, and that eventually all reservations will be made through the tribe's tourism office. Technology has given us lots of ways to track our sleep. From apps on our phones to devices we wear, there's no shortage of data on our Zs. But how do we translate that information into a better night's sleep? To help sort that out, I'm joined by Michael Grandner, director of the Sleep and Health Research Program and Behavioral Sleep Medicine Clinic at the University of Arizona. So, Michael, how useful is all this data to us?
It depends on the device. Sometimes it can be very useful. So, one thing to remember about sleep is we never have an exact measurement of sleep when we're studying humans. You know, sleep comes from the middle of the brain, and we can't measure that directly. So we need other ways of estimating when people are asleep and when people are awake. So which is why we use things like brain waves measured from the outside of the brain in a lab to things like movement, which is actually a remarkably good way to estimate sleep. But at the end of the day, a lot of these are estimates, and the quality and the reliability of these estimates depends on whether the underlying technology is well-calibrated and well-suited for sleep.
Well, even with sort of the best data, how do we go about using that, I guess, to try to improve our sleep, try to get more, better sleep?
So I like that you said more, better, because there's two dimensions here. Like diet, the amount of calories you get is important, but also the quality of those calories are important. And with sleep, it's the same way. The amount of sleep you get is important, but also the quality. You can get plenty of sleep time, but if your sleep is shallow and broken up, it's still not going to be quite as good. And so one really useful way to use this information, first of all, is to get a sense of what's going on.
At the risk of asking an incredibly oversimplified question, what about some of this technology is better than if you wake up in the morning and you're tired, you know that maybe you need more sleep or you need better sleep, and if you wake up feeling well rested, you know you're doing okay?
Well, that's one indicator. So how you feel when you wake up is actually really important, and these devices can't even tell you that. Another good indicator is if you're falling asleep within seconds of your head hitting the pillow. That's actually also a very important thing to know where you shouldn't be. It should take you a few minutes. If you're falling asleep too quickly, that's a sign of sleep deprivation. But one thing that these apps can tell you is, first of all, they can tell you sort of what you're doing over time. They can say, look, in general, I'm getting, 6 to 7 hours. In general, I'm getting 7 to 8 hours. And you can mesh that with sort of how you're feeling during the day. But also, it can say, you might get a window into, wow, my sleep looks way more broken up than I feel like it is. I wonder if I'm not sort of feeling great during the day, or maybe I'm waking up feeling okay, but the afternoon I'm just feeling really sluggish and really hard to pull through, maybe looking into your sleep might be a good window and seeing what might be going on. And it's also important to point out that people are generally a very bad judge of how impaired they are regarding sleep loss. Just like we're not really a good judge of how drunk we are, we're not really a good judge of how sleep deprived we are.
Is this the kind of thing, do you think, that as technology continues to improve and advance, that we will see more devices and more ways to determine how we're sleeping, how well we're sleeping, how to improve our sleep, that sort of thing?
Oh, definitely. And one thing that I think that's very exciting about this is more attention drawn to sleep. I think it's very, if anything, it's very strange that something we spend so much time doing that's a biological requirement for life. And if you think about that, what else is on that list besides food, water, breathing? Sleep is on that list. We need it to survive. We spend a whole lot of our time doing it, yet we don't really give it much mind. And that's to our detriment. Now, what's out there right now is imperfect, and technology will always be getting better. But the better windows we can get on this period of time that's really biologically important, yet we're unconscious when it happens, can help us make better choices for our health and mental well-being and relationships and our job. I mean, all of these things filter in.
Michael Grandner is director of the Sleep and Health Research Program and Behavioral Sleep Medicine Clinic at the University of Arizona. He's also an assistant professor of psychiatry there.
Researchers used to think the brain stopped producing neurons after a certain age, that the cells just died off as we got older. Now research suggests older brains thrive with the right combination of physical and social activity. From the Arizona Science Desk, Lou Gum reports for KJZZ.
It's no different for the elderly that the brain is like a muscle. It gets stronger with use. And for some older adults, part of the remedy is bowling.
So you bowled a 156, is that pretty good?
For me it is.
Irene McKelkey just rolled a strike and a spare to finish a game at Inca Lanes, Yuma's only bowling alley, and a nice air-conditioned reprieve on a hot summer afternoon. She smiles as she talks, and her eyes flash back and forth to the lanes as she watches for her turn.
I'm 71, okay. I had stage 4 breast cancer. I had a back operation 2 years ago, and I wanted to get back to the bowling.
Irene is very active, like most of the seniors here today. Besides bowling, she plays pool, rides her bike, walks every day, and is involved with her church. Her husband was the more artistic one, she says. He died 10 years ago, and she lost her brother just last year.
Yes, he had dementia, something on this order. But I try to keep my mind active. Read crossword puzzles, word search, whatever, just to try to keep going. I may end up with it, I probably will. But take my word for it, it's not going to slow me down.
Physical activity is considered the most critical factor to keep senior neurons firing, even if you're having a not-so-great bowling day.
Mediocre.
Like 70-year-old Sharon Best. Best's mother and grandmother had Alzheimer's. She's concerned about it, but she thinks her best strategy is to keep on the move, and she wants to be around others.
You got to have people around you. Otherwise, you get stagnant. Things don't work anymore.
There's truth in that. Older brains also thrive on contact with others.
And now, we are going to do plunking.
A dozen seniors sit in a circle at Daybreak Adult Care Center run by Catholic Social Services in Yuma. Aides encourage the group to follow along with a workout video. 82-year-old Isabel Nelson only half participates in the exercises.
I'd like to be, but I'm not.
And she'd rather watch.
They do quite well. And I'm very tolerant.
Nelson is a former nurse. She started to come here 5 months ago after her husband died, and her son encouraged her to move to Yuma.
And he had said, why don't you go down to the senior center? and it's been wonderful for me.
Nelson says she's always kept busy, but the center provides plenty of interaction with her peers.
I'm an RN by profession, and a lot of them come to me with their little problems and things that I can't do much about, but I just love being around them.
And Nelson loves engaging with them. Her brain likes it too. The more social she is, the more her brain makes new connections. Jorge Merced directs senior theater groups in New York City, and he's on the board of the National Center for Creative Aging. Merced was in Yuma last month for a symposium to share best practices for the aging community in Arizona. Merced believes new knowledge about seniors and their brains shatters the stereotype that the elderly are solitary people in decline.
And it breaks with the whole idea of isolation, that you no longer participate in society, the whole notion that an older adult is a drain in the economic life of a community. It's the other way around. The older adult can contribute to that economic life of any society and to the well-being of any society. And so that's why we feel like it's best to concentrate on the assets and the strength as opposed to the faults and the deficits of growing older.
Good things to keep in mind, especially considering that 10,000 people in this country turn 65 every day. For the Arizona Science Desk, I'm Lou Gum in Yuma.
Today would have been the Dutch master Rembrandt's 410th birthday, which makes it seem like a good time to look at the somewhat controversial issue of how he painted. The British artist David Hockney and University of Arizona Optical Sciences and Physics professor Charles Falco have developed a theory that Rembrandt and several of his contemporaries used mirrors and other lenses in their painting. Professor Falco joins me, and first off, can you explain what has become known as the Hockney-Falco thesis?
Well, what we've determined from actually a number of studies of artists of that period, that certain artists, name brand artists like Rembrandt, Van Eyck, Caravaggio, Bellini, used optical projections. They projected images on the canvas, and then they used that to make an optical mark on the canvas to reproduce certain aspects of the paintings in extremely good detail, or in Rembrandt's case, portraits that are very lifelike.
So was this almost like projecting something on a canvas and then just tracing it as opposed to painting it freehand?
Well, yes and no. To think about these as just tracings is an oversimplification, because these artists, what they needed to do was to capture certain features that allowed them to make them very realistic. But it really didn't take very much to do that. In the case of a portrait, corners of the eye, position of the nose, corners of the mouth, not much more than that is required to give a good artist everything they need to do to have all the really lifelike aspects of the portrait. And then the hair, the face, things like this, the skin, that can be done just by eyeball.
In some ways, was there some measure of ingenuity to figure out that this method would be effective for art?
Well, one problem people have today is that most people, everyone has a phone with a camera in it. And every picture that they take, they just push a button and the photograph ends up in focus, properly exposed. That's not the case if you project a image at large magnification. Like, think about going to an art museum. Portraits are half life size, or heads are close to life size. In your camera, the image is a few millimeters tall on the sensor in a camera. Large images have shallow depths of field, and it's very difficult to do. So it took quite a bit of ingenuity on the part of an artist to do this.
I know that you are a scientist and not an art historian or an art critic, but given your work on this and given your work with the artist David Hockney, I'm curious to get your perspective on almost the question of so what? So if you use these things, what does it matter?
Well, there's so what at a couple different levels. That one so what is answered by, if you look at the paintings of Western Europe, suddenly around, say, 1430, there was a dramatic transition in their realism. This has been known for hundreds of years. Everyone knew about it. Nobody knew why. We explain why. Lenses explain why. And we've shown at the same time this sudden transition to reality occurs, say in Van Eyck's paintings, Van Eyck is one of the very first people who we've found optical evidence that shows he used optical projections. So the so what actually really transforms our understanding of all of Western art post 1400 or so. So if that's important to you, and it should be important to art history students, that answers that so what question. The other sort of aspect of so what is that it actually is a big deal. It's hard for an artist to do this. It's not trivial for them to do. So if you thought somebody like Rembrandt was a genius, you actually underestimated him. He was more of a genius than you gave him credit for.
Well, I was going to ask you if, in your mind, this revelation takes away from Rembrandt's work, but it sounds like it actually enhances it in your mind.
Absolutely. The people, again, people who sort of dismiss it as saying, well, you know, I can take a picture and have it in focus. What's the big deal? Don't understand how difficult it is to project an image at nearly, well, half-life size with the shallow depth of field and make use of it. So it was a very clever person who was able to do that and to make use of it.
Charles Falco is a professor of optical sciences and physics at the University of Arizona. Charles, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The pink bollworm used to be the bane of cotton farmers, but you won't find any of these tiny caterpillars in cotton fields today. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says this is the last year it's checking fields before it'll officially declare the pest eradicated.
And that's partly thanks to a USDA facility in Phoenix that mass-produced sterile bollworm moths and released them into the fields, reducing population. As the show's Annika Klein reports, it's the only facility of its kind, and it's now setting its sights on doing the same with a new pest, the navel orange worm.
You might be thinking the navel orange worm is a threat to the citrus industry.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That's Ian Davis, the director of the pink bollworm rearing facility.
It's not particularly a pest of concern to the citrus industry.
This caterpillar is wreaking havoc on the nut industry, maturing inside the shells and eating the nut meat. When they become moths, they're not a threat anymore. That's why growers are interested in using sterile navel orange worm moths to cut down the numbers. And Davis says it's similar to how the cotton industry paid for the bollworm project.
The navel orange worm project is 100% funded by the pistachio industry.
They might not see returns on that investment for a while. This isn't something that happens overnight. But it could reduce costs long term. David Haviland is with the Integrated Pest Management Program at the University of California and says the costs of dealing with this pest right now are huge.
On every acre of almonds or pistachios in California, the growers will spend $200, $300, sometimes $400 on an acre just doing what's called mummy removal.
That means clearing out all the leftover nuts after harvest, which are prime real estate for moths to lay their eggs. And that's just one strategy of many. Farmers also use pesticides that Haviland says are expensive and a paperwork nightmare.
If the growers can use this sterile technique to actually avoid pesticide use altogether, that would be an ideal situation for both the farmer as well as for the consumer that's concerned about how their food is produced.
This climate-controlled windowless room is home to some of the bollworm moths that are left. Earl Andrus is an entomologist with a rearing facility. He pulls out a tray of 6 plastic containers, each about as big as a margarine tub.
With the pink bollworm, you get 3,000 from each one of these cells.
3,000 times 840 containers, we're standing in a room of more than 2.5 million bollworms. But that's nothing compared to what they used to produce.
At the peak, we were consistently producing well in excess of 28 million a day.
And it was more than twice what they expected. They created a really efficient system. The orange worms are proving more difficult. Andrew says they like their space.
Our production is a 25th of what it is with pink bollworm.
So it costs more to produce, and you need more of these moths to be effective. Bob Curtis is with the Almond Board of California.
The navel orange worm is a very, very strong flyer. And the question then becomes, how much area can you release into?
Until they have more answers, Curtis and some others in the nut industry aren't sold yet on the sterile release method.
There's other work in the field that needs to happen.
Ian Davis says they're sending a shipment of sterile moths to California next month.
To see how well these things disperse when you release them, how easy they are to recapture, a lot of things of that nature.
Then they'll understand better what they're up against.
One of the things the Pink Bollworm Program taught us over the years is that you don't know where or what your breakthroughs will look like until you make them.
They do know success would mean another win for farmers. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.